state to that man, and I felt my face burning. I shook my head. A red-haired woman said, "Oh, come on, you've been here 4 times. You haven't said a word. Why should we expose ourselves so you can leave here every day all smug and silent and tell our secrets to your friends in bars?" The man with the communion story said, "Yeah, I put myself on the line here, buddy. We'd like to hear from you. What's your plan? You gonna sit in your ass and let us do the work?" Henry asked Irma, young woman to my left, what she thought of me, and I was surprised when she massaged my shoulder and said she felt power. She said she'd like to be a student in my class, that I must be a good teacher. "Do you hear that, Frank?" said Henry. "Power." I knew they were waiting for me to say something. I felt I should make a contribution. "I once slept with a prostitute in Germany," I said. "Oh, well," said the red-haired woman, "give him credit. He tried." "Big deal," said the communion man. "Tell us about it," said Irma. "I went to bed with her." "So?" said the red-haired woman. "That's all. I went to bed with her. I paid her 4 marks. Henry saved me. "Time is up. See you next week." I never went back. I thought he might telephone to see why I dropped out, but Alberta said they were not supposed to do that. You had to make up your own mind, and if you didn't return, it meant you were sicker than ever. She said a therapist could do only so much, and if I want you to take chances with my mental health, your blood be upon your head. What? It's from the Bible. I am leaving the office of Professor Walton, head of the English department at Trinity College. He said yes, quite, to my application for admission to the doctoral program, and yes, quite, to my dissertation topic, Irish-American Literary Relations 1889 to 1911. Why these terminal dates? In 1889, William Butler Yeats published his first book of poetry, and in 1911, in Philadelphia, Abbey Theatre actors were pelted with various objects after a performance of The Playboy of the Western World. Professor Walton said, "Interesting." "My dissertation mentor would be Professor Brenda Kennelly," he said, "a fine young poet and scholar from County Kerry. I was now officially a Trinity man, exalted, dwelling in marble halls. I tried to walk out the front gate like a man accustomed to walking out that front gate. I walked very slowly so that the American tourists would notice me. Back in Minneapolis, they tell the folks how they spotted an authentic, debonair Trinity man." When you're admitted to the doctoral program at Trinity, you might as well celebrate by walking up Grafton Street to MacDade's pub, where you sat long ago with Mary from Bewley's. A man at the bar said, "Over from America, I suppose?" How did he know? It's the clothes. You can always tell a Yank by the clothes, he said. I felt friendly, told him about Trinity, the dream come true. He turned hostile. "Jesus, it's a sad fucking day when you have to come to Dublin for a fucking university. Don't they have tons of them in America? Or is it the way they didn't want you? And are you a Protestant or what?" Was he joking? I'd have to get used to the ways of Dublin men. It was dawning me that I was an outsider, foreigner, returned Yank, and on top of it, a Limerick man. I thought I'd come back a conquering hero, a returned Yank with college degrees, bachelor and master, man who survived nearly 10 years in the high schools of New York. I made the mistake of thinking I'd fit into the warm life of Dublin pubs. I thought I'd move in a circle so bright, witty, and literary that American scholars prowling its periphery would relay my every bon mot to academia back home, and I'd be invited to lecture on the Irish literary scene to irresistible co-eds at Vassar and Sarah Lawrence. It was not to be. If there was a circle, I was never part of it. I prowled the periphery. I stayed in Dublin for 2 years. My first apartment was at Seaview Terrace off Aylesbury Road, where William Thackeray lived when he rode his horse around Ireland as a postal inspector, and every morning wrote 3,000 words. My landlady told me his ghost still walked, and she was convinced the manuscript of a major novel was hidden in the walls of his old house. I knew the ghost of Mr. Thackeray was in residence because of the way the grease was suddenly congealed around my fried eggs and rashers when he made his midnight rounds. I explored the apartment looking for that manuscript, till the neighbors complained about my knocking on the walls at all hours. I floundered in Dublin. I started every day with the best intentions. I had morning coffee at Bewley's and worked at the National Library or the Trinity College Library. At noon, I told myself I was hungry and strolled off for a sandwich at a nearby pub, Neary's, MacDade's, the Bailey. A sandwich needs to be washed down with a pint, and as the wag said, bird never flew on one wing. Another pint might loosen my tongue and help me chat with other customers, and soon I convinced myself I was enjoying myself. When the pubs closed for the afternoon holy hour, I had coffee again at Bewley's. It was all procrastination. Weeks passed, and my research into Irish-American literary relations was going nowhere. I told myself I was an ignoramus who knew nothing of American literature and had a sketchy grasp of Irish literature. I would need background, and that meant reading the histories of both countries. When I read Irish history, I filled index cards with any reference to America. When I read American history, I filled index cards with any reference to Ireland. Reading the histories was not enough. Now I had to read the major authors and discover how they influenced or were influenced by their counterparts on the other side of the Atlantic. Of course Yeats had American connections and influences. Of course Edmund Dowden of Trinity College was one of the first Europeans to champion Walt Whitman. But what was I to do with all this? What was I to say? And after all my troubles, would anyone give a fiddler's fart? I had made other discoveries, and off I went snuffling down paths far from American transcendentalism and the Irish literary revival. Here were accounts of the Irish hacking and digging and fighting and singing on the Erie Canal, on the Union Pacific Railroad, and in the American Civil War itself. On opposite sides, Irishmen often fought their own brothers and cousins. It seemed that wherever there was a war, the Irish fought on both sides, even in Ireland. At school in Limerick, we heard repeatedly the long, sad story of Ireland's sufferings under the Saxon heel, but barely a word about the Irish in America, their building and fighting and singing. Now I read about Irish music in America, the power and genius of the Irish in American politics, the exploits of the Fighting 69th, the millions who cleared the path to the Oval Office for John F. Kennedy. I read accounts of how mean Yankees discriminated against the Irish all over New England, and how the Irish fought back and became mayors, governors, party bosses. I kept a separate pile of index cards for the story of the Irish in America, a pile that grew higher than the one on literary relations. It was all enough to keep me away from the pubs at lunchtime, enough to keep me from the work I should have been doing on Irish-American literary relations. Could I change my dissertation topic? Would Trinity allow me to present some aspect of the Irish in America, politics, music, the military, entertainment? Professor Walton said that would not be possible in the English department. I seemed to be straying into history, and that would require approval of the history department, which he doubted would be possible since I had no background in history. I'd already spent a year at Trinity and would have only one more year to finish my dissertation on Irish-American literary relations. The professor said, one must keep one's hand firmly on the helm. How could I tell my wife in New York I'd squandered a year exploring the ditches and rail beds of Irish-American history, when I should have been improving my knowledge of literature? I hung on in Dublin, making feeble attempts at shaping some kind of dissertation. If I went to a pub lunch and cleared my head with a pint, surely there would be an insight, a flash of inspiration, surely. My money went over the bar. The pint came back, nothing else. I sat on a bench in St. Stephen's Green, coveting the office girls of Dublin. Would they run away with me to Coney Island, Far Rockaway, the Hamptons? I watched the ducks in the pond and envied them. All they had to do in the war was quack, paddle, and open their mouths for morsels. They didn't have to worry about the dissertation that was killing me. How and why did I ever get into this? Jesus! I could be in New York, grateful for my lot, teaching my 5 classes a day, going home, having a beer, going to a movie, reading a book, cooing to the wife, and so to bed. Oh, but no, little snotty-nosed Frankie from the lanes of Limerick tried to rise above his station, climb the social ladder, mingle with a better class of people, the quality of Trinity College. This is what you get, Frankie, for your paltry ambition. Why don't you run down the street and buy yourself a Trinity scarf? See if that will lift your spirits, help you write that grand original study of Irish-American Literary Relations 1889 to 1911. There is an activity called pulling yourself together. I tried. But what was there to pull together? The second year in Dublin dribbled away. I couldn't find my niche there. I didn't have the personality or the self-confidence to shoulder my way into a group, be one of the lads, buy my round, and make the witty comments you're supposed to hear in Irish pubs. I sat in the library and added to my mountain of index cards. Drinking added to my addle-headedness. I went for long walks around the city, up one street and down the other. I met a woman, a Protestant, and we went to bed. She fell in love with me, and I didn't know why. I wandered the streets of Dublin looking for the door. I had a notion that in any city there was a way in for the outsider and the traveller. In New York, for me, it was the schools and bars and friendship. There was no door for me in Dublin, and I had to admit finally what ailed me. I missed New York. At first, I resisted the feeling, go away, leave me alone, I love Dublin, look at the history, every street is brimming with the past. I dreamt of Dublin when I was a child in Limerick. Yes, but yes, but yes, as my Uncle Pat Keating would say, you're going on 40, so it's time to shit or get off the pot. Before I left Trinity, Professor Walton glanced over the index cards and said, my, my. In January of 1971, I returned to New York, a failing doctoral candidate. Alberta was pregnant. We'd conceived the summer before, during our fortnight stay in Nantucket. I told her I could continue research at the 42nd Street Library in New York. She was impressed with my bag of index cards, but wanted to know what purpose they served. Every Saturday I sat in the south reading room of the 42nd Street Library. I should have sat in the north reading room in the literature section, but I found the lives of the saints in the south, and they were too gripping to be ignored. Then I happened on accounts of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, how the Irish and the Chinese coming from opposite directions competed, how the Irish drank and undermined their health, while the Chinese smoked opium and rested, how the Irish didn't care what they ate, while the Chinese nourished themselves on the food they knew and loved, how the Chinese never sang while they worked, and how the Irish never stopped for all the good it did them, the poor, crazy Irish. Alberta went on maternity leave, and I took her place back at Seward. But a month after I started at Seward Park High School, the principal died of a heart attack. Then I met the new principal in the elevator, the department chairman who'd fired me from Fashion Industries High School. I said, are you following me? And when his mouth tightened, I knew, once again, my days were numbered. A few weeks later, I sealed my doom. In the presence of other teachers, the principal asked, so, Mr. McCourt, are you a father yet? No, not yet. Well, what do you want, a boy or a girl? Oh, it's all the same to me. Well, he said, as long as it's not a neuter. Well, if it is, I'll train it to grow up and be a principal. The letter that I was being accessed soon followed, signed by Assistant Principal Acting Mitchell B. Schulich. A failed everything. I looked for my place in the world. I became an itinerant substitute teacher, drifting from school to school. High schools called me for day-to-day work to replace sick teachers. Some schools needed me when teachers were called for long spells of jury duty. I was assigned classes in English, or wherever a teacher was needed, biology, art, physics, history, mathematics. Substitute teachers like me floated somewhere on the fringes of reality. I was asked daily, "And who are you today?" "Mrs. Katz." "Oh." "And that's what you were. Mrs. Katz, or Mr. Gordon, or Ms. Newman. You were never yourself. You were always, oh." In the classroom, I had no authority. Assistant principals sometimes told me what to teach. But students paid no attention, and there was nothing I could do. The ones who came to class ignored me and chatted, asked for the pass, rested their heads on desks and dozed, floated paper airplanes, studied for other subjects. I learned how to discourage them from coming to class at all. If you want an empty classroom, all you have to do is stand at the classroom door and scowl. They'll decide you're mean and run. Only Chinese came to class. They must have been warned by their parents. They sat in the back and studied, resisting my subtle hints that they disappear too. Principals and their assistants looked displeased when they saw me sitting at the teacher's desk, reading the paper or a book in a near-empty room. They said I should be teaching. That's what I was hired for. I would gladly teach, I said, but this is a physics class, and my license is in English. They knew it was a silly question, but there were supervisors and had to ask, "Where are the kids?" Everyone in every school knew the rule. When you see a substitute teacher, run, baby, run. Part 3. Coming Alive in Room 205. A year after I returned from Dublin, our old friend Arlene Dahlberg introduced me to Roger Goodman, head of the English department at Stuyvesant High School. He asked if I'd be interested in covering the classes of Mr. Joe Curran for a month or so while he convalesced from something. Stuyvesant was said to be the top high school in the city, the Harvard of high schools, alma mater of various Nobel Prize winners, of James Cagney himself, a school where, as soon as a boy or girl was admitted, doors opened to the best universities in the country. 13,000 candidates sat every year for the Stuyvesant admissions test, and the school skimmed off the top 700. Now I taught where I could never have been one of the 700. When Joe Curran returned after a few months, Roger Goodman offered me a permanent position. He said the kids liked me, that I was a vital, engaging teacher, that I'd be a valuable addition to the English department. I was embarrassed by this praise, but I said yes, and thank you. I promised myself I'd stay only 2 years. Teachers all over the city vied for jobs at Stuyvesant High School, but I wanted to be out in the world. At the end of a school day, you leave with a head filled with adolescent noises, their worries, their dreams. They follow you to dinner, to the movies, to the bathroom, to the bed. You try to put them out of your mind. Go away, go away. I'm reading a book, the paper, the writing on the wall. Go away. I wanted to be doing something adult and significant. Going to meetings, dictating to my secretary, sitting with glamorous people at long mahogany boardroom tables, flying to conventions, unwinding in trendy bars, sliding into bed with luscious women, entertaining them before and after with witty pillow talk, commuting to Connecticut. When my daughter was born in 1971, my fantasies faded before her sweet reality, and I began to feel at home in the world. Every morning I gave Maggie her bottle, changed her diaper, dipped her bottom in warm, soapy water in the kitchen sink, resisted the morning newspaper because of the time it would consume, stood with the rush hour crowd on the train from Brooklyn to Manhattan, walked along 15th Street to Stuyvesant, made my way through a crowd of waiting students to the front door, pushed in, said good morning to the guard, punched in at the time clock, took a pile of papers from my mailbox, said good morning to teachers punching in, open the door to my empty classroom, room 205, opened windows with the long pole, sat and looked over the empty desks, relaxed for the few minutes before my first class. Thought of my daughter gurgling that morning in the kitchen sink, watched dust dancing in the shaft of sunlight piercing the room. Took the attendance book from a drawer and spread it on the desk. Erased from the blackboard grammar notes from last night's French lesson in the adult evening school. Opened the classroom door, said hi to the surge of students in the first class. Roger Goodman said it was important to teach diagramming. He loved the structure and Euclidean beauty of it. I said, oh, because I knew nothing about diagramming. He told me these things at lunch in the gashouse bar and restaurant around the corner from the school. Roger was short and bald, his baldness offset by rich, bushy, black and gray eyebrows and a short beard, which lent him a twinkling impishness. He lunched with teachers. That made him unusual among assistant principals, who reminded me of the Cabots and Lodges. In Boston, the home of the bean and the cod, where Cabots speak only to Lodges and Lodges speak only to God. Some afternoons, Roger came to the gas house to drink with us. He had no affectations, always cheerful, always encouraging. A supervisor you could feel comfortable with. He put on no airs, no intellectual pretensions, and mocked bureaucratic gobbledygook. I don't think he could have uttered pedagogical strategizing without chuckling. He trusted me. He seemed to think I could teach on any of the four levels of high school, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. He even asked what I'd like to teach and took me to the room where books were organized by grade. It was dazzling to see them ranged on shelves, reaching to the 20-foot ceilings and stacked on carts for delivery to classrooms. There were anthologies of English, American, and world literatures, piles of The Scarlet Letter, The Catcher in the Rye, The Painted Bird, Moby Dick, Arrowsmith, Intruder in the Dusk, Lie Down in Darkness, Introduction to Poetry by X. F. Kennedy. There were dictionaries, collections of poetry, short stories, plays, textbooks on journalism and grammar. "Take whatever you want," said Roger, "and if there's anything else you'd like, we can order it. Take your time. Think about it tonight. Let's go to the gas house for lunch." School. Books. Lunch. It was all one to Roger. He did not change hats. At day's end, when teachers lined up to punch out and rush home, he'd waggle his eyebrows and invite you around the corner for a stirrup cup, one for the road. For the long journey to his apartment at the far end of Brooklyn, a man needed sustenance. He'd sometimes drive me home. On three martini days, a drive slow and deliberate. Perched on the cushion that elevated his short body, he'd hold the steering wheel as if guiding a tugboat. Next day he'd confess he didn't remember much about the drive. In my years of teaching, this was the first time I felt free in the classroom. I could teach whatever I liked. If outsiders stuck their heads in the door, it didn't matter. When Roger came for a rare observation, he wrote enthusiastic, positive reports. He broke down my resistance to anyone in the world a step or two above me. I told him what I was doing in my classes, and all I got was encouragement. Sometimes he'd slip in a word or two about the necessity of teaching diagramming, and I promised to try it. After a while, it was a joke. I tried, but failed. I made lines vertical, horizontal, slanting, and then I stood adrift at the blackboard till a Chinese student volunteered to take over and teach the teacher what the teacher should have known. My students were patient, but I could tell from the looks they exchanged and the traffic in notes passing back and forth that I was in a grammar wilderness. At Stuyvesant, they had to know grammar for their classes in Spanish, French, German, Hebrew, Italian, Latin. Roger understood. He said, "Maybe diagramming is not your strong point." He said some people just don't have it. Arlene Dahlberg had it. Joe Curran certainly had it. After all, he was a graduate of Boston Latin, a school 2.5 centuries older than Stuyvesant, and, he claimed, more prestigious. Teaching at Stuyvesant for him was a step down in the world. He could diagram in Greek and Latin and probably French and German. That's the kind of training you get at Boston Latin. Jesse Lowenthal had it too, but of course he would. He was the oldest teacher in that department with his elegant three-piece suit, the gold watch chain looping across his waistcoat front, his gold-rimmed spectacles, his old-world manners, his scholarship. Jesse, who did not want to retire, but when he did, planned to spend his days studying Greek and drifting into the next life with Homer on his lips. It pleased Roger to know that he had in his department a solid core of teachers who could be relied on to diagram at a moment's notice. Roger said it was sad Joe Curran had such a drinking problem. Otherwise, he could have entertained Jesse with miles of Homer from memory. And if Jesse was up to it, Virgil and Horace, and the one Joe favored out of his own great anger, Juvenal himself. In the teacher's cafeteria, Joe told me, "Read your Juvenal so you'll understand what's going on in this miserable fucking country." Roger said it was sad about Jesse. Here he is in his twilight years with Christ only knows how many years of teaching under his belt. He doesn't have the same energy for 5 classes a day. He asked to have his load reduced to 4, but no, oh no. The principal says no, the superintendent says no, all the way up the bureaucracy they say no, and Jesse says goodbye. Hello, Homer. Hello, Ithaca. Hello, Troy. That's Jesse. We're going to lose a great teacher, and boy, could he diagram. What he did with a sentence and a piece of chalk would stun you. Beautiful. If you asked the boys and girls of Stuyvesant High School to write 350 words on any subject, they might respond with 500. They had words to spare. If you asked all the students in your 5 classes to write 350 words each, then you had 175 multiplied by 350, and that was 43,750 words you had to read, correct, evaluate, and grade on evenings and weekends. That's if you were wise enough to give them only one assignment per week. You had to correct misspellings, faulty grammar, poor structure, transitions, sloppiness in general. You had to make suggestions on content and write a general comment explaining your grade. You reminded them there was no extra credit for papers adorned with ketchup, mayonnaise, coffee, coke, tears, grease, dandruff. You suggested strongly they write their papers at desk or table and not on train, bus, escalator, or in the hubbub of Joe's original pizza joint around the corner. If you gave each paper a bare 5 minutes, you'd spend on this one set of papers 14 hours and 35 minutes. That would amount to more than 2 teaching days and the end of the weekend. You hesitate to assign book reports. They are longer and rich in plagiarism. Every day I carried home books and papers in a fake brown leather bag. My intention was to settle into a comfortable chair and read the papers, but after a day of 5 classes and 175 teenagers, I was not inclined to prolong that day with their work. It could wait, damn it. I deserved a glass of wine or a cup of tea. I'd get to the papers later. Yes, a nice cup of tea, and a read of the paper, or a walk around the neighborhood, or a few minutes with my little daughter when she told me about her school and the things she did with her friend Claire. Also, I ought to scan a newspaper in order to keep up with the world. An English teacher should know what's going on. You never knew when one of your students might bring up something about foreign policy or a new off-Broadway play. You wouldn't want to be caught up there in front of the room with your mouth going and nothing coming out. That's the life of the high school English teacher. The bag sat on the floor in a corner by the kitchen. Never far from sight or mind, an animal, a dog waiting for attention. Its eyes followed me. I didn't want to hide it in the closet for fear I might forget completely there were papers to read and correct. There was no point in trying to read them before dinner. I'd wait till later, help with the dishes, put my daughter to bed, get down to work, get that bag, man. Sit on the couch where you can spread things out, put some music on the phonograph or turn on the radio, nothing distracting, some acoustic syrup, music to grade papers by. Settle yourself on the couch. Rest your head a minute before you tackle the first paper on your lap. My stepfather, the jerk. More teen angst. Close your eyes a moment. Ah, drift, teacher, drift. You're floating. A slight snore wakes you. Papers on the floor. Back to work. Scan the paper. Well written, focused, organized. Bitter. Oh, the things this girl says about her stepfather. That he is a bit too familiar with her. Invites her to movies and dinner when her mother works overtime. And there's the way he looks at her. Mother says, oh, that's nice. But there's something about her eyes and then the silence. Writer wonders what she should do. Is she asking me, the teacher? And should I do something? Am I to respond, help her out of her dilemma? If there is a dilemma, stick my nose into family matters where it doesn't belong? She could be making it up. What if I say something and it gets back to stepfather or mother? I could read and evaluate this paper objectively, congratulate the writer on the clarity and development of her theme. That's what I'm there for, isn't it? I'm not supposed to get involved in every little family squabble, especially in Stuyvesant High School, where they like to let it all hang out. Teachers tell me half these kids are in therapy, and the other half should join them. I'm not a social worker or a therapist. Is this a cry for help? Or another teenage fantasy? No. No, too many problems in these classes. Kids in other schools were never like this. They didn't turn the class into group therapy. Stuyvesant is different. I could give this paper to a guidance counselor. Here, Sam, you take care of this. If I didn't, and it came out later that the stepfather abused the girl and the world knew I'd let it slip by, important people in the school system would summon me to their offices, assistant principals, principals, superintendents. They'd want explanations. How could you, experienced teacher, let this happen? My name might even blaze across page 3 of the tabloids. Make a few marks with the red pen. Give her a 98. The writing is terrific, but there are spelling errors. Congratulate her on writing that is honest and mature and tell her, Janice, you have great promise, and I hope to see more of your work in the coming weeks. They have ideas I want to dissipate about the private lives of teachers. I tell them, in your head, choose one of your teachers. Don't tell anyone the name. Don't write it down. Now speculate. When that teacher leaves the school every day, what does he or she do? Where does he go? You know, after school, teacher goes directly home. Carries a bag filled with papers to be read and marked. Might have a cup of tea with spouse. Oh no, teacher would never have a glass of wine. That's not how teachers live. They don't go out. Maybe a movie on the weekend. They have dinner, they put their kids to bed, they watch the news before they settle in for the night to read those papers. At 11, it's time for another cup of tea or a glass of warm milk to help them sleep. Then they put on pajamas, kiss the spouse, and drift off. Teachers' pajamas are always cotton. What would a teacher be doing in silk pajamas? And no, they never sleep naked. If you suggest nudity, students look shocked. Man, can you imagine some teachers in this school naked? That always triggers a big laugh. And I wonder if they're sitting there imagining me naked. What is the last thing teachers think about before sleeping? Before they drift off, all those teachers, snug and warm in their cotton pajamas, think only of what they might teach tomorrow. Teachers are good, proper, professional, conscientious, and they'd never throw a leg over the other one in the bed. Below the belly button, the teacher is dead. In 1974, my third year at Stuyvesant High School, I'm invited to be the new creative writing instructor. Roger Goodman says, you can do it. I know nothing about writing or the teaching of it. Roger says, don't worry. Across this country, there are hundreds of teachers and professors teaching writing, and most have never published a word. And look at you, says Bill Ince, Roger's successor. You've had pieces published here and there. I tell him a few pieces in the Village Voice, Newsday, and a defunct magazine in Dublin hardly qualifies me to teach writing. It will be common knowledge soon that in the matter of teaching writing, I don't know my arse from my elbow. But I remember a remark of my mother's. God help us, but sometimes you have to chance your arm. I can never bring myself to say I teach creative writing or poetry or literature, since I'm always learning myself. Instead, I say I conduct a course or I run a class. I have the usual 5 classes a day, 3 regular English, 2 creative writing. I have a homeroom of 37 students with the clerical work that entails. Each term, I'm given a different building assignment, patrolling hallways and stairwells, checking boys' lavatories for smoking, substituting for absent teachers, watching for drug traffic, discouraging hijinks of any kind, supervising student cafeterias, supervising the school lobby to ensure that everyone coming or going has an official pass. Where 3,000 bright teenagers are gathered under one roof, you can't be too careful. They're always up to something. It's their job. They moaned when I announced we were going to read A Tale of Two Cities. Why couldn't they read The Lord of the Rings, Dune, science fiction in general? Why couldn't they? Enough. I ranted at them about the French Revolution, the desperation of people drained by tyranny and poverty. I was one with the downtrodden French and having a grand time with my righteous indignation. To the barricades, mes enfants. They gave me the look, the one that says, here we go again, another teacher with a bug up his ass. Not that you care, I jeered. Even now there are billions of people who don't slide out of their warm white sheets every morning to relieve themselves in warm white bathrooms. There are billions who know nothing about hot and cold running water, bars of perfume, soap, shampoo, conditioner, great luxurious towels with the naps thick as your skulls. Their faces said, oh, let the man talk. You can't win when teachers are like that. Nothing you can do about it. Talk back, and he gets out the old red pen and makes the little red mark that drops your grade. Then your dad says, what's this? And you have to explain, teacher has a bug up his ass about the poor or something. Your dad doesn't believe you, and you're grounded for a million years. So, best thing is to keep your mouth shut. With parents and teachers, you can't go wrong with a shut mouth. Just listen to him. You'll go home today to your comfortable apartments and houses, head for the refrigerator, open the door, survey contents, find nothing that will please you. Ask Mom if you can send out for pizza, even though you'll have dinner in an hour. She says, sure, honey, because you have a hard life going to school every day and putting up with teachers who want you to read Dickens, and why shouldn't you have a little reward? Even during the rant, I knew they were seeing me as another great, predictable, two-faced pain in the arse. Did they know I was enjoying it? Teacher as demagogue? It wasn't their fault if they were bourgeois and comfortable, and wasn't I carrying on that old Irish tradition of begrudgery, so back off, Mac. In the front, under my nose, Sylvia raises her hand. She's black, petite, and stylish. Mr. McCourt! Yes. Mr. McCourt! What? You're losing it, Mr. McCourt. Chill. Relax. Where's that big old Irish smile? I was about to bark that the sufferings of the French poor that triggered the revolution were not a smiling matter, but the class drowned me out with laughter and applause for Sylvia. Yay, Sylvia, you go, girl. She smiled up at me. Oh, those great brown eyes. I felt weak and foolish. I slid to my chair and let them joke the rest of the period about how they'd mend their ways. They'd be worthy of Charles Dickens. They'd start by giving up the afternoon pizza, the money they saved they'd sent to descendants of the poor people in the French Revolution, or they'd give it to the homeless on First Avenue, especially the man who was insulted if you offered him less than $5. When the class ended, Ben Chan lingered in the room. Mr. McCourt, could I talk to you? He knew what I was saying about poverty. The kids in this class didn't understand anything, but it wasn't their fault, and I shouldn't get mad. He was 12 when he came to this country 4 years ago. He knew no English, but he studied hard and learned enough English and mathematics to pass the Stuyvesant High School entrance exam. He was happy to be here, and his whole family was so proud of him. People back in China were proud of him. He competed against 14,000 kids to get into the school. His father worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, in a restaurant in Chinatown. His mother worked in a downtown sweatshop. Every night she cooked dinner for the whole family, 5 children, her husband, herself. Then she helped him get their clothes ready for the next day. Every month she had younger ones try on the clothes of the older kids to see if they'd fit. She said when everyone was grown and none of the clothes fit anymore, she'd keep them for the next family from China, or she'd send them right over there. Americans could never understand the excitement in a Chinese family when something came from America. His mother made sure the children sat at the kitchen table and did their homework. He could never call his parents silly names like Mom or Dad. That'd be so disrespectful. They learned English words every day so that they could talk to teachers and keep up with the children. Ben said everyone in his family respected everyone else, and they'd never laugh at a teacher talking about the poor people of France, because it could just as easily be China, or even Chinatown, right here in New York. I told him the story of his family was impressive and moving, and wouldn't it be a tribute to his mother if he were to write it and read it to the class? Oh no, he could never do that, never. Why not? Surely the kids in this class would learn something and appreciate what they have. He said no, he could never write or talk to anyone else about his family, because his father and mother would be ashamed. Ben, I feel honored you told me about your family. Oh, I just wanted to tell you something I wouldn't tell anyone else in case you were feeling bad after that class. Thanks, Ben. Thank you, Mr. McCourt, and don't worry about Sylvia. She really likes you. Next day, Sylvia stayed after class. Mr. McCourt, about yesterday. I didn't mean to be mean. I know, Sylvia. You were trying to help. The class didn't mean to be mean either. They just hear grown-ups and teachers yelling at them all the time. But I knew what you were talking about. I have to go through all kinds of stuff when I go down my street every day in Brooklyn. What stuff? Well, it's like this. I live in Bedford-Stuyvesant. You know Bed-Stuy. Yes, black neighborhood. So, there's nobody on my street ever going to go to college. Whoops! What's the matter? I said gonna. If my mom heard me say gonna, she'd make me write going to 100 times. Then she'd make me say it 100 times. So what I'm saying is, when I walk to my house, there are kids out there jeering at me. Oh, here she come. Here come Whitey. Hey, Doc, you scrape yourself and you'll find that honky skin. They call me Doc because I want to be a doctor. Of course I feel sorry for the poor French, but we have our own troubles in Bed-Stuy. What kind of doctor will you be? Pediatrician or psychiatrist? I want to get to the kids before the streets get to them and tell them they're no good, because I see kids in my neighborhood afraid to show how smart they are, and the next thing is they're acting stupid in vacant lots and burned-out buildings. You know, there's a lot of smart kids in poor neighborhoods. Mr. McCourt, will you tell us one of those Irish stories tomorrow? For you, Dr. Sylvia, I would recite an epic. This stuck in my memory like a rock forever. When I was 14 growing up in Ireland, I had a job delivering telegrams. One day I delivered the telegram to a place called the Good Shepherd Convent, a community of nuns and lay women who made lace and ran a laundry. There were stories in Limerick that the lay women in the laundry were bad women known for leading men astray. Telegram boys were not allowed to use the front door, so I went to a side door. The telegram I was delivering required an answer, so the nun answering the door told me step inside, that far and no farther, and wait. She put down on her chair a piece of lace she was working on, and when she disappeared down the hallway, I peered at the design. A little lace cherub hovering over a shamrock. I don't know where I found the courage to speak, but when she returned, I told her, "That's a lovely piece of lace, sister." That's right, boy. And remember this. The hands that fashioned this lace never touched flesh of man. The nun glared at me as if she hated me. Priests were always preaching love on Sundays, but this nun probably missed the sermon. And I told myself if I ever had a telegram again for the Good Shepherd Convent, I'd slip it under the door and run. Sylvia said, "That nun. Why was she so mean? What was her problem? What's wrong with touching flesh of man? Jesus was a man. She's like that mean priest in James Joyce going on about hell. You believe all that stuff, Mr. McCourt?" I don't know what I believe, except that I wasn't put on this earth to be Catholic, or Irish, or vegetarian, or anything. That's all I know, Sylvia. When I discussed A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man with my classes, I discovered they were ignorant of the seven deadly sins. Blank looks around the room. I wrote on the blackboard, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. If you don't know them, how can you enjoy yourselves? So like Mr. McCourt, what does this have to do with creative writing? Everything. You don't have to be poor and Catholic and Irish to be miserable. But it gives you something to write about and an excuse for drinking. No, wait, I take that back. Delete the part about drinking. When my marriage collapsed, I was 49. Maggie, 8. I was broke and slept in a series of friends' apartments in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Teaching forced me to forget my troubles. I could cry into my beer at the Gas House or the Lion's Head Bar, but in the classroom I had to get on with business. In a while, I'd borrow money from the teacher's pension fund to rent and furnish an apartment. Till then, young Kling invited me to stay in the apartment he rented on Hicks Street near Atlantic Avenue. Yonk was an artist and restorer in his 60s. He came from the Bronx, where his father was a politically radical doctor. Any revolutionary or anarchist passing through New York was welcome to a dinner and a bed at Dr. Kling's. Yonk went through World War II working in graves registration. After a battle, he searched the area for bodies or parts of bodies. He told me he never wanted to fight, but this was worse. And he often felt like asking for a transfer to the infantry where you just shot your man and moved on. You didn't have to finger the dog tags of the dead or look in their wallets at pictures of wives and kids. Young still had nightmares, and his best cure or defense was a generous shot of brandy, something he always kept in his bedroom. I could gauge the frequency of the nightmares by the level in the bottle. He painted in his room. He moved from bed to chair to easel, and everything was part of everything else. When he woke, he'd lie in bed, smoke a cigarette, study the canvas he worked on the day before. He brought his mug of coffee from the kitchen to the bedroom, where he sat in a chair, and continued looking at the canvas. He'd dab at the work from time to time to correct or erase something. He never finished his coffee. There were half-filled mugs all over the apartment. When the coffee turned cold, it curdled and developed a ring halfway down the cup. There was one scene he painted over and over on canvases of various sizes. A group of women in bright pastel headscarves and long, flowing, silky dresses stood on a beach looking out to sea. I asked him if someone had drowned, or were they waiting for something. He shook his head. He didn't know. How could he? He just put those women there and he wasn't going to interfere with them. That's what he disliked about certain artists and writers. They interfered and pointed to everything, as if you couldn't see or read for yourself. Not Van Gogh. Look at Van Gogh. There's the bridge, there's the sunflower, the room, the face, the shoes. Come to your own conclusion. Van Gogh ain't telling you. He had two other subjects, racehorses and dancing Hasidim. He showed horses coming around the bend. That's where the horse's body is most fluid, he said. Anyone can paint a horse out of the gate or heading for the finish line. That's just straight horse from nostril to tail, but coming around the bend, man, They're tilting and straining and sideswiping, adjusting to the bend, finding a slot for the stretch. The Hasidim were wild. Six men in black costume, black hats and long black coats, hair and beards flying out. You could almost hear the high clarinet wail and the fiddle chirp and soar. Yonk said he didn't give a damn about religion himself, Judaism or anything else, but if you could dance your way to God like the men in his picture, then he was right with them. At the aqueduct track, I watched him watching. He seemed to be the only one at the track interested in what he called the laggard nags, the ones who trailed in at the end of the field. He ignored horses being led into the winner's enclosure. Winning was winning, but losing made you dig deep. Before I knew Yonk, I saw nothing but groups of horses being pointed in one direction and running their hearts out till one of them won. I looked through his eyes at a different aqueduct. I knew nothing about art or the mind of the artist, but I knew he took horse and rider images home in his head. At dusk, he'd invite me for a brandy in his corner room, where we looked down Atlantic Avenue toward the waterfront. Trucks grunted up the avenue, wheezing and hissing when they changed gears at the red traffic light, while the ambulances of Long Island College Hospital screamed day and night. We could see the blinking red neon sign for Montero's Bar, a gathering place for seamen off freighters and container ships, and the ladies of the night who made them welcome to Brooklyn. Pilar Montero and her husband Joe owned the bar and building on Atlantic Avenue. She had a vacant apartment over the bar that I could have for $250 a month. She could give me a bed, some tables and chairs, and I know you'll be happy up there, Frankie. She said she liked me. Because of the time, I said I preferred Spanish bagpipes to Irish bagpipes, and I wasn't like the rest of the Irishers who wanted to fight, 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 all they ever wanted to do. The apartment looked out on Atlantic Avenue. Outside my window, the Montero Bar neon sign blazed on and off, turning my front room from scarlet to black to scarlet, while on the jukebox downstairs the village people sang and pounded YMCA. I could never tell my classes how I lived over one of the last waterfront bars in Brooklyn, how every night I struggled to drown out the sounds of rowdy sailors, how I stuffed cotton wool in my ears to muffle the shrieking and laughing of women who offered shore love, how the pounding of the jukebox in the bar below, the village people singing YMCA, had jolted me nightly in my bed. At the start of each term, I told new students of creative writing, "We're in this together. I don't know about you, but I'm serious about this class and of one thing. At the end of the term, one person in this room will have learned something, and that person, my little friends, will be me." I thought that was clever, the way I presented myself as the most eager of all, elevating myself above the masses, the lazy, the opportunists, the indifferent. English was a required subject, but creative writing was an elective. You could take it or leave it. They took it. They flocked to my classes. The room was packed. They sat on windowsills. One teacher, Pam Sheldon, said, "Why don't they just let him teach in Yankee Stadium?" That's how popular I was. What was this enthusiasm for creative writing? Did the boys and girls suddenly want to express themselves? Was it my masterly teaching, my charisma, my Irish charm, the old faith and begorra factor? Or had the word spread that this McCourt just rambled on and then dispersed high marks as easily as peanuts? I didn't want to be known as an easy marker. I'd have to toughen my image, tighten up, organize, focus. Other teachers were spoken of in awe and fear. Up on the fifth floor, Phil Fisher taught mathematics and terrified all who came before him. The stories came down. If you struggled with the subject or showed little interest, he roared, "Every time you open your mouth, you add to the sum total of human ignorance," or "Every time you open your mouth, you detract from the sum total of human wisdom." He could not understand how any human brain could find difficulty with advanced calculus or trigonometry. He wondered why the stupid little bastards could not apprehend the elegant simplicity of it all. At the end of the term, his stupid little bastards flaunted passing grades from him and bragged of their achievement. You could not be indifferent to Phil Fisher. Ed Marcantonio was the chairman of the mathematics department. He taught in a room across the hall from mine. He taught the same courses as Phil Fisher, but his classes were oases of reason and serious purpose. A problem was presented, and for 40 minutes he led or urged the class toward an elegant solution. When the bell rang, his students, satisfied, floated serene in the hallways, and when they passed Ed's course, they knew they had earned it. Adolescents don't always want to be set afloat on seas of speculation and uncertainty. It satisfies them to know that Tirana is the capital of Albania. They don't like it when Mr. McCord says, "Why was Hamlet mean to his mother?" or "Why didn't he kill the king when he had the chance?" It's all right to spend the rest of the period going round and round discussing this, but you'd like to know the answer before the goddamn bell rings. Not with McCourt, man. He's asking questions, throwing out suggestions, causing confusion, and you know the warning bell is about to ring, and you get this feeling in your gut, come on, come on, what's the answer? And he keeps saying, what do you think, what do you think? And the bell rings, and you're out in the hallway knowing nothing, and you look at other kids from the class pointed to their heads and wondering where this guy is coming from. You see the kids from Mark Antonio's class sailing down the hallway with that peaceful expression that says, we got the answer, we got the solution. Once! Just once, you wish McCourt had the answer to something, but no, he throws everything back at you. Maybe that's how they do it in Ireland, but somebody should tell him, this is America and we like answers here. Or maybe he doesn't have the answers himself, and that's why he throws everything back to the class. I wanted to teach with Fisher passion and Marcantonio mastery. It was flattering to know that hundreds wanted to be in my classes, but I wondered about their reasons. I didn't want to be taken for granted. Oh, McCourt's class is just bullshit. All we do is talk. They all yak, yak, yak. If you don't get an A in his class, man, you're just plain stupid. Jan Kling was having an afternoon brandy at Montero's. He told me I looked like shit. Thanks, Jan. Have a brandy. I can't. I have 1,000,000 papers to correct. I'll have a glass of Rioja, Pilar. Good for you, Frankie. You like the Spanish bagpipes. You like the Rioja. You find a nice Spanish girl. Keep you in bed all weekend. I sat up on the bar stool and told Yonk my story. I think I'm too easy. There's no respect for easy teachers. One teacher at Stuyvesant was called something for nothing. I want to make them earn their grades, have respect. They're signing up for my classes by the hundreds. That bothers me. The idea those kids might be saying I'm easy. One mother came to the school and pleaded with me to let her daughter into my class. Mom was divorced and offered to spend a weekend with me in a resort of my choice. I said no. Yonk shook his head and said that sometimes I was not too bright, that there was an element of the tight ass in my character, and if I didn't loosen up, I'd slide into a miserable middle age. Christ, man, you could have spread joy. A weekend with the mother, a bright writing future for a little girl. What's the matter with you? There wouldn't be any respect. Oh, the hell with respect. Have another Rioja. No, Pilar. Give him some of that Spanish brandy on me. All right, but I have to go easy, Yonk. All these papers... 170 papers, each 350 words if I'm lucky, 500 if I'm not. I'm buried. He said I deserved 2 brandies and didn't know how I did it. He said, all you teachers, I don't know how you do it. If I ever became a teacher, I'd have one thing to say to those little bastards. Shut up. Just shut up. Tell me this. Did you let the little girl into your class? Yes.